Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Gordon M. Ameth Jr.
Edelmiro Abad.
Their names were read by children today, young survivors of those who died in the worst terrorist attack in U.S. history. In the 2 years since that day, propelled by outrage and history and national character and fear, America has taken a dramatic, distinctive course. There might have been others. There may still be others. This is the path we're on.
Oh, my God. That was the second tower of the World Trade Center collapsing before our
they, eyes. Our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts.
Kermit Charles Anderson.
Yvette. We will go after that group, that network, and those who have harbored, supported, and aided that network to rip the network up. And when we were through with that network,
every nation, in every region, now has a decision to make. Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
Senior.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
And my uncle, Stephen Palacino, we miss you so much.
The facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war.
What will follow will not be a repeat of any other conflict. It will be of a force and scope and scale beyond what has been seen before.
Downtown Baghdad this morning, we're seeing evidence of the collapse of any central regime authority. The streets are full of people celebrating.
Ashley, Thomas J.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
We found that 80...
Special representative of the Secretary General, Mr. Sergio Vieira de Mello, is at least badly wounded. This is really an outrage against people who have come from all parts of the world to help Iraq. There is no other reason that the staff of the United Nations are here.
J. Bear Walter. Andrew J. Bailey.
I will soon submit to Congress a request for $87 billion.
Brett.
The request will cover ongoing military and intelligence operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and
Michael
elsewhere.
S. Baksh.
Sharon M. Balcom.
2 years on, Andrew two Bates. Wars after 9/11, Catherine the country Davis. Is on a path Robert you may Jesus. Or may not have expected Walter on that Barbara. One terrible day in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania. Tonight we step back and try to define the road the country has taken, the history that propels its choices, and we'll look at other roads, other options that have not been taken but may yet be. We're taking a deep compass reading. How do you describe the path the country is on? Were there, are there, alternative paths in response to 9/11? Or is the United States making the best of a bad situation? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Michael Ignatieff, director of the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University, author of many books, including The Warrior's Honor, Ethnic War, and the Modern Conscience. His latest article, Why Are We in Iraq?, appeared Sunday in the New York Times Magazine. Good evening and welcome, Michael Ignatieff.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Very good to have you. Also with us in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you right here on this stage.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Michael.
Michael Ignatieff, you listened along with all of us to the sounds from today and the sounds of these past 2 years. It is an incredible 2 years, two wars, many decisions made. We want to try and and put some frame around this tonight, a fresh frame, if we have any fresh perspective at the two-year point. And I wonder if you can help us by beginning with a kind of a rough definition of the path we're on, of the choices that we've made. You think strategically, you think about foreign policy. It was a world of options, maybe. How do you describe the decisions made here, the path we're on?
Well, I think it's, I mean, first of all, I'm enough of a historian to know that we're like kids with our noses up against the glass. We're too close. I feel like a kid today in a way. I listen to those kids reading those names and feel that kind of, the heartbreak is still so fresh, it's very difficult to see it at all. That's the first thing to say. And the event makes fools of analysts like me. I mean, it's just too big. It's too early to say. But what I would say is this, that, you know, I'm a Canadian. I'm not an American. So I lived through September 11th and saw a national community. We forget that the United States is a national community, one of the strongest national communities in the world. And at that moment in September 11th and afterwards, I remember feeling very vividly, my wife, also a non-citizen, felt the same thing. We were watching a national community mourn as a national community. 2 years on, this is a much more divided country. The war divided America deeply. The divisions are now very sharp. There's a kind of vituperation and bitterness and anger, a sense of betrayal often towards the president, which is very different from what was going on 2 years ago. That's one path we've taken, I think, towards division. Another aspect of the story is we're much more alone now than in September 12th. What I remember so vividly about September 12th is all of our allies, the entire so-called civilized world, whatever that means, suddenly said we were attacked too. Well, the interesting thing 2 years on is the rest of the world thinks you were attacked. We weren't attacked at all. Mm-hmm. And I think that sense of, on the one hand, being more divided than we were 2 years ago.
Internally.
And externally being much more alone than we ever expected puts us in a spot we did not imagine. Now, your excellent question, could we have done differently? That's a tough one. Don't know what to answer to that.
Well, so there are the big parameters, certainly less unified internally, maybe more alone globally. But look at this piece. The Bush administration sat back, the country sat back and supported in many ways after 9/11 and said, all right, here's what we're going to do. Now, we heard the president's words again tonight in political rhetoric, in kind of hortatory, a call to arms. But as an academic observer, how would you say, here's what the United States decided to do? How would you describe it?
I think what the United States decided to do was, we've been attacked and we will respond. A very strongly unilateral response, basically. Like a wounded animal, responding alone. There was another path, I think, which was much more, as we say, multilateral. Working alliances, building coalitions. But there was a strong sense of we got that at the beginning of the hour. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. The president brought the chopper down. Mm-hmm. You were on one side or you on the other. In fact, a lot of the world didn't want to fit in on one side or the other. We got good alliance cooperation. But the cumulative effect of a set of unilateral policies meant that when we wanted to do Iraq, suddenly, I think the moment of truth for a lot of Americans was to see how incredibly isolated the United States was through that Security Council debate. That was a moment when we suddenly thought, holy smoke, where are these allies? We spent 55, 60 years driving this train. Everybody used to be on board.
Helping them out, our umbrella over them.
And suddenly, there's nobody in sight. I mean, I'm a Canadian, as it happens. You know, my people weren't with you. They just weren't with you.
And they're right across the border.
Yeah, they're your best friends. They know you better than anybody else. They weren't with you. You know, and half of the British public, the British came with you, but half of the British public wasn't with you.
And if it had been more multilateral, what would that have meant about the actual content of whatever was done? Would it have changed?
Well, you know.
Would it have been different, I should say?
I think it would have been different, but it would have been an awful lot slower. We might not be, we either would not be at war or we'd be going to war now. But we'd be going to war in a coalition. And I think that would have affected the legitimacy of what then happened. The United States made a choice to go it alone. I don't want to, you know, throw dust over my past. I was in favor of military action.
In Afghanistan, in Iraq.
In Iraq, even unilaterally, where I now see much more painfully than I saw at the time, were the costs of that decision. The costs are high. They are getting higher by the moment. It is extremely, it's one thing to get people on the train before you go in. It's an awful lot harder when a lot of boys have been shot in Baghdad, when it's a dangerous place, to get multilateral coalition support from the people who ought to be with us, the Germans, the French. The thing that America, the single difficulty that America has had since September 11th is understanding the limits of its strength. It's terribly hard for the most powerful, richest, most dynamic national community on earth to understand it needs friends. It needs help. It cannot do all this stuff alone. And that, I think, is the real reckoning here that America's struggling with.
And that it's up against now. Jack Beatty, you know how life is. Something happens, there's a chain of events, and they come to seem inevitable. That this is, of course, this is how it had to be. This is how it is. But maybe not. And we want to try and get our elbows out tonight and see if there was some more range, see if there's still yet some more range. When you look back at the decisions made, where we are now, at the range of options around, do you see much of a penumbra there?
Well, men must choose, as Isaiah Berlin said. And, you know, there was one road not taken, and it could be taken yet. Let's imagine it's September 12th and the president is speaking. My fellow Americans, I want to talk to you about three things: energy, Saudi Arabia, and you. Energy. We are embarking tomorrow on what I call the 9/11 project. This project will essentially... one of the things it'll do is help save the planet for the 21st century. It will make America the center of all alternative energy technologies, and it will immunize us to the degree we can against dependence on a very shaky source. And to pay for this, I'm going to rescind the trillion-dollar tax cut. That belonged to a different world. We're going to spend $250 billion on this project. We're going to harness the best brains in the country. And we are going to, as I say, the 9/11 project will be in the memory of the people who died.
And break that dependence on oil.
That's right. The Saudis. No one has told you about this, Americans, but this is a bad situation there. These people have corrupted us. We've corrupted them. It's been a case of our blood for their oil. It's got to stop, and it's going to stop now. There's strong evidence that officials in the government were somehow involved in this, and a longer train of evidence that private wealthy officials in Saudi Arabia, 20 families, helped pay for these people. 15 to the 19 people were from Saudi Arabia. Partly it's the domestic policies of that regime that that produced this repression. Partly it's the Wahhabist brand of Islam it preaches. Tomorrow they have to stop supporting mosques. Tomorrow they have to give us the people we want. Tomorrow they have to stop their charities. You, what is your role in this? Well, your role is to pay higher gas taxes. Your role is to drive tomorrow when you the carpools all over this country. Your role is to volunteer and can conserve energy. And why? Because America's young men and women are too precious to lose unless we have to. Oh, we'll fight. But we don't fight until we absolutely have to. You don't want them to die so you can drive a big car, do you? No. Well, we're going to make this a better world. This is a chance to turn history right now.
Jack Beatty's take on what the president might have said on September 12th or 29th, 2001. Michael Ignatieff, realistic? Pie in the sky? Were the options as wide as that? Or did it have to be the iron fist?
It's a great line from Jack. I think a lot of Americans might have thought you're changing the subject on me. Do you know what I mean? The politics of that would have been difficult on the 15th, 16th.
You mean we just got punched?
Yeah, we just got punched. You're changing the subject. Now, but I don't want to duck this because Jack's got a big point, and there's a larger point here. Did the president ask Americans to make enough sacrifices, to change their story enough? I think Jack is picking up on the sense that the president thought, basically, things can go on as they are. We're just going to go out and clobber some people. And that may have been the mistake he made. He didn't draw on the best in Americans.
Michael Ignatieff, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're talking tonight about the road the United States has taken since 9/11 and the roads not taken. How do you think Americans of the future will look back on our generation's response to 9/11? This is On Point.
Japhet Jesse Ari, Patrick Asante, Carl Francis Asaro.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's the second anniversary of 9/11/01. We're talking tonight about the road the United States has taken since 9/11 and the roads not taken, roads maybe still to be taken. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you describe the path the country has taken? Are there alternative paths in response to 9/11? And what face of the national character have we shown since 9/11? Are there other elements of that character that might be useful to bring forward? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest in studio with us tonight, Michael Ignatieff, director of the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University. His latest article in the Sunday Times was, Why Are We in Iraq? But he was a supporter of military intervention in Afghanistan and in Iraq, like all of us. He's looking around on this second anniversary. We're joined now from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, by William Luchtenberg. He's professor emeritus of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, author of many books, including Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal. He was the winner of the Bancroft Prize and the Francis Parkman Prize, former president of the Society of American Historians and the American Historical Association, one of the most honored historians in the country. Good evening and welcome, William Luchtenberg.
Hello, nice to be with you.
Very good to have you with us. I know you've been listening in a bit. We want to get some perspective tonight, if you're good enough to share it with us, on how you see the way the country has responded to 9/11 in these last 2 years and how it fits in a historical context, in historical patterns. But maybe the first question to you is, you know, broad headline, how would you define the response as we've seen it?
Well, to begin with, I don't think that we have any clear notion of why we went to war. About a year ago, I was the keynote speaker at a gathering, and that evening, about half a dozen of us sat around a table for dinner, and every person around the table had a different explanation of why it is that we went to war. It was because of a radical right within the administration. It was because Bush was trying to complete what his father had failed to do. It was because of ties of a president and a vice president with the oil industry with respect to oil in the Middle East, and it went on in that fashion. And I agree with what Michael Ignatieff said, that we are so close to this. Our nose is right up against the window. It'll probably be years before we can come up with an answer. And there may not be a single answer, of course. Several of these things may be going on at the same time.
But as citizens, we've got decisions to make and a stream of decisions to make. If indeed your pals sitting over dinner couldn't figure out why we went to war in Iraq, what does that say to you about the overall response since September 11th? How would you characterize it?
Well, I think that the leadership of the country is largely responsible for what the popular attitudes are going to be. At a time of a crisis, the country is always going to rally to the president. We remember how much damage the captivity in Tehran did to Jimmy Carter's presidency. What we forget is that in the days and weeks immediately after it happened, Jimmy Carter's ratings rose in the polls.
Mm-hmm.
It is unlikely that the American people are going to take a position, at least initially, sharply different from that of the leadership. And Bush sent out the kind of cues that that Jack was talking about from the very outset, and the country, understandably badly scared, went along with what the administration was saying.
You spent a lot of time studying Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You've looked closely at Pearl Harbor, an event often cited in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Are there precedents here for this kind of, I mean, when you look at Pearl Harbor, when you look at 9/11, does it just make sense to you that the United States would pull out the military in response to that kind of blow? Does history say, well, of course this is what America did?
Well, I think that the response to Pearl Harbor was inevitable. And I would say that the same thing was true with respect to our intervention in Afghanistan. There's been very little criticism, save for those people who think that all you have to do is saying, let's give peace a chance. For the most part, both abroad and at home, there was a recognition that something had to be done about the people who attacked us, to move against the Taliban. The problem came considerably later with the decision to intervene in Iraq. And the one big distinction between the way Bush has operated and the way Franklin Roosevelt operated is that he was very, very careful to develop what he called the United Nations, a term long before the international organization was created, to describe the coalition of forces. We could not have won World War II without the support of so many other countries in the world, Great Britain, mm-hmm. Russia, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, so many other nations, and he created that broad coalition, which is what Bush has failed to do.
So you're saying it's well within the historical precedent. The country responds to the lead of the president in the aftermath of a crisis, of a blow. But are there other strands of national character that are going to play out here? Do you see the posture the country has taken since 9/11 as sustainable? Does it fit with the national character?
Well, I think that there are some things about the response that are disturbing. One is the unwillingness of the country to examine what the rationale is for the intervention. And that falls into more than one area. Two-thirds of the country believed that Saddam Hussein was in cahoots with al-Qaeda, was responsible for the terrible events of September 11th, when there's no evidence for that whatsoever, not even within the administration is that believed. And in addition, it's disturbing that the American people have been so willing to denounce, particularly the French, but other members of the so-called non-nine-yet coalition, a willingness to think that it's possible for the United States to go it alone. And if other countries do not accept our rationale, that's their fault.
Bill Luxtenberg, you give us perspective here. Michael Ignatieff, you're saying, hey, there comes a point at which even the U.S. runs up against the limits of its power. You supported war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, but yet we see what's happened. And now in what you're writing, we're feeling you tap the brakes, saying, hey, if you go too far alone, even this superpower may prove a vulnerable giant. Are there alternative paths that the country must consider at this point?
Well, I've argued in that piece that you kindly refer to in the New York Times that the United States can't impose a Pax Americana on a reluctant world. The real shocker since 9/11 is not that the United States has enemies. It's always had enemies and always will have enemies. The shocker has been that its friends have pulled away from it. And its friends, you can only get so much mileage by, you know, making fun of Dominique de Villepin, Jacques mm-hmm. Chirac. I have no brief for the foreign policy of that country, but it must be disturbing to Americans that you know, Western European democracies who share our values, who share our commitments, who have deep memories of gratitude for the exercise of American power and freeing them after World War II, are so deeply opposed. The United States should never make its foreign policy a business of pleasing other people. That's not my point. But it has to be worrying when there is that deep hostility. I think the conclusion, the alternative way to go, is you've got to go back to the United Nations. The United Nations is a mess. I'm not the world's greatest fan of the United Nations. But the United Nations would not exist without the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt, as Professor Leutenberg makes clear. This is a moment where the United States could say, look, we need you, you need us, let's change the rules here. Let's exercise some leadership. The continued recourse of the United States to the use of military force is leading, I think, ultimately into a cul-de-sac. And I think this is what we're looking like in Iraq. I supported the operation because I felt I had to choose between, do I want Saddam Hussein in power on September 11th, 2003, or not? And I think I didn't. But we can't go on with the unilateral exercise of American power. The world will not be shaped by American power and force. It'll be shaped by leadership, by persuasion, by working in concert with our friends. That's what Roosevelt did understand. That was, and this is a bipartisan understanding. I'm not making a political point here. Mm-hmm. Republicans have understood that the same way Democrats have done.
President Bush's father played that fiddle.
Absolutely. And it seems to me that's where the United States has got to go. It's got to simply invest much more in multilateral frameworks, in multilateral arrangements. And some of this is crude national interest stuff. I'm not giving you a sentimental story here. Mm-hmm. If you ask yourself, what has made a difference in the war on terror since in the last 2 years? What actions have increased the security of Americans? They've been breaks by the Pakistani police, by the German police, by the Spanish police, by the UK police.
By the Syrians.
Yeah.
Even the Syrians.
Mm-hmm. You know, we need these folks. We need them in the worst kind of way. And that's the thing that Americans, I think, in the wound, in the pain of 9/11, have thought, we can do it all ourselves. We can't do it all ourselves.
We have to count on other people. You've got some radical ideas about how to pursue that, but I want to invite our callers in first. Michael Ignatieff, William Luxemburg, Jack Beatty, stand by. Kailash is calling from Boston. Hi, Kailash. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show. First of all, my condolences and heartfelt, sharing of the grief of the families of 9/11, first thing. I want to say that long before terrorism was something that was looked at in the U.S., I personally encountered it in India as part of the special forces of the Indian Army in Punjab and in Kashmir.
Mm-hmm.
My two comments and a quick question. First of all, I think Jack hit the nail right on the head. The president missed a great opportunity to tell the country what really was at stake in terms of our energy policy and our dependence on Saudi or Middle Eastern oil.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a lost opportunity. I hope we get an opportunity to address that issue again. The second comment is, the whole theme has been that we need friends in the world. I think America cannot go it alone. I echo that thought. I agree with it wholeheartedly. You know, we just have to sort of look carefully around the world. There are lots and lots of countries who are willing to help America. I see this in all my travels. I work for a major pharmaceutical company and spend 50% of my time or more in Europe. They basically say, look, guys, you can't do it alone, but the rest of the world is here to help you. If only you will take their help.
But Kailash, the Bush administration seems to portray much of the rest of the world as trimmers, as slackers, as not ready to step up and do the necessary.
I don't necessarily agree with it. If you speak to the common person in the street in Germany or in Britain or in Switzerland, they basically tell you, look, you have an arrogant attitude that they need to lose.
And you've got a question, Kailash. Give us that.
The last question was, where does the rest of the world stand with us today? I mean, I know the coalition sort of fell apart, but going forward, what does your expert panel see as where we go forward with the coalition? Are we going to get the support of the rest of the world, or are we going to drift further apart? I'll take my answer off the air.
We'll pick it up. Thanks for your call, Michael Ignatieff. Well, we are where we are at this point, and there's some smoke rising over any number of bridges. Can they be rebuilt? Will it take a major change in U.S. strategy, in the U.S. perspective on the world and the war on terror, to rebuild those bridges?
I think the bridges can be rebuilt. I'd be interested in what Jack thinks about this, because I think that structurally, long-term, Western Europe in particular understands that its security interests, its economic interests, its values are deeply connected to a strong and successful America. I don't believe this stuff about the Atlantic getting wider and wider and Europe and the United States necessarily drifting apart. If that happens, that'll be bad leadership, loose lips, political stupidity. It doesn't have to happen because there are real organic interests here. They want open economies. They want free markets. They want secure air travel. They want to have a world which is moving forward. They don't want a world bust up into protectionist competitive blocks. So there's lots to work on here, but we've all got to lower the rhetoric. We got to stop talking, about French fries and getting in a state about the French. I mean, there's a lot of kind of stupid chaff here, but it's getting in the way. And then we've got to look back at American diplomacy and admit occasionally that we've made some mistakes. There were some mistakes made in the presentation of the case for war. There were mistakes made in what was said to the American people. One of the things that's very dangerous here is the ways in which, you know, I supported the war, but I'm not sure that the American people were told the truth about the reasons for going to war. And you can't mess with a democracy like that and not have consequences.
And you're talking about Iraq here.
Yes. And ditto, we weren't straight with our allies about that. So there's some trust to rebuild. There's some apologies to make. And it seems to me recognition that we didn't do so great would help here.
William Luchtenberg, Michael Ignatieff describes the first impulse to go unilateral after 9/11 as a kind of almost visceral response to such a almost unprecedented wound. Do you interpret it that way? Why do you think Washington went so unilateral after such an outpouring of support immediately after 9/11? What was moving in the thinking in Washington, D.C. that was so ready to shuck off decades of multilateral?
Well, I was in Europe on 9/11, and I recall vividly what the response was. In the next day's newspaper in Austria said, "Wir sind Amerikaner," we are Americans. Mm-hmm. The same thing that was said in the in the French press. And I recall the minutes of silence that in Vienna the following day. And I think that there was not a great deal of disturbance about the unilateral action of the United States with respect to Afghanistan. The problem came later with respect to Iraq.
And why? Why did Washington go down that path?
Well, as I said a few minutes ago, that's an answer. I don't think that I don't think we know the answer to. But there's one important point I think that could be made on this. This was not inevitable because of something that is inevitable in American leadership or the American national character. If there had been a few less dangling chads in Florida in 2000, if Al Gore had been president, I think it is highly unlikely that we would have pursued this course in Iraq. And I think, moreover, that it is highly likely that there would have been a program with respect to energy, given Gore's interest in the environment, much along the lines of what Jack Beatty was saying. So that this election that turned on so very few votes, with Gore getting the larger number of popular votes, had consequences far beyond anything that can be called a popular mandate or than any of us anticipated in the days after the election.
Well, that's where we're living right now. We're talking tonight about the road the United States has taken since 9/11 and the roads not taken, maybe still to be taken. You can join the conversation. Do you still support the idea of the war on terror? Is that the way to survival or to lost opportunity? If you could steer the country right now, how would you steer it? Steady as she goes or in a new direction? This is On Point.
Scott Walter Cahill.
Thomas Joseph Cahill.
George Kane.
Salvador B. Calabro.
Joseph M. Calandrio.
And our Uncle William Bernstein.
We miss you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight on the second anniversary of the tragedy of 9/11/01 about the road the United States has taken since that terrible day. And the road's not taken, maybe still to be taken. My guests tonight are William Luchtenberg, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and with us in the studio, Michael Ignatieff, Director of the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University. On Point news analyst Jack Beatty is here as well. You can join us. Is the United States making the best of a bad situation for you, for your children, for your grandchildren? What's the best way, the best path to remember to redeem the dead of 9/11? Are we on the right path? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Greg's calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hi. We're definitely on the right path. The cost of this thing is several hundred dollars per year per person in the United States. I'm willing to pay that for my family. You know, I had got into an argument with a friend of mine the other day about how we're going after Iraq and the people in Iraq were not responsible for 9/11, as if to say the best argument against what we're doing is that we're going to make subtle and significant distinctions between the people who took hostages in 79 or Hamas or Osama bin Laden or the Taliban or the Ba'ath Party or the people in the Middle East who simply just want to have 7th century Islamic rule. Come on, people. This is really, really important. And night after night, you, Tom, and Jack just keep harping over the same issues. I mean,
but Gregor, what are you saying? There was a tattoo in Vietnam. It said, kill them all, let God sort them out. Is that what you're suggesting for the Middle East?
Well, if you want to talk about Vietnam, which is, you know, the poster child for the left's, you know, cause that war just doesn't work, that was an epic battle. It was the front of the epic battle, the most epic battle that we've ever fought between Western civilization, capitalist, libertarian society, and, you know, in the classical libertarian sense, versus communism and totalitarianism. And we want to hold up Vietnam as the failure of that. When I see it a little bit differently, in a historical perspective, it was the right thing to do. It was done wrong, but that war needed to be fought on many fronts, and it's a good thing it was.
Well, Greg, we're going to keep asking about where it's going because, you know, not everything's going just perfectly, and we want to keep our eyes wide open. But we're wide open to your view as well, that we're on the right path. Michael Ignatieff, here's the voice that says, don't get your knickers in a twist over too many distinctions here. We've got a conflict. Let's look at it head on and just go up and take it on.
Look, I think the one of the things we have to focus on in the future is weapons of mass destruction passing into the hands of super empowered individuals like Osama bin Laden, like and groups like Hezbollah. There is a problem out there. I don't think the Bush administration invented the nightmare scenario that we're all looking down the barrel of, which is the capacity that weapons of ultimate lethality would pass out of the hands of a state into the hands of super empowered people with a grudge against the United States.
No one wants that to happen.
No one wants that to happen. And that, I think, when you look at the 9/11 2 years on, a lot of what's weighing on our shoulders is a sense of a war without end against enemies who have increasing increments of lethal power and no very clear strategy about how to bring that under control. Iraq seems to me to have been a lunging attempt to actually deal with a substantive issue. What do you do when a guy sitting on top of the second proven oil resources in the world is fooling around? We don't know whether he's got them, but he's definitely fooling around with this stuff. Because if that's happening, then we have to do something. And that's the unresolved issue here as we move forward, a sense that we've started a war without end. We don't know how to bring it to an end. We've got an ever-increasing risk, which we don't know how to handle. You can't wish that stuff away.
Something had to be done.
This is why this is a grim anniversary. It's not merely that mistakes have been made. We can all add up what the mistakes were. But the substantive issue, still unanswered, is what do you do about WMD in a world when it escapes out of the power of states? That's a new horizon. That's a new problem. And we haven't got the right answers.
And does that mean fundamentally, Michael Ignatieff, that you're still saying Bush was right to pull out the gun?
Well,
That the speech about energy and solidarity wouldn't cut it?
We needed a speech about solidarity. We needed a speech about energy. I'm not disagreeing with Jack there. He's asked America to go into war without end, without making any sacrifices. The tax cuts don't add up. The sense that we can have this on the cheap doesn't add up. The sense that we can redo Iraq and it's not going to cost us a dime doesn't add up. It's the failure to tell Americans what this actually entails. Yeah. We are in a lot of sacrifices are called. But on the straight issue, what do you do about WMD down the road? The president has raised an issue which isn't an invention. Mm-hmm. Yep. He didn't cause this issue to arise. It has to be dealt with. And just to come back to the final point, if you ask yourself how you're going to deal with it, you got to have friends. How are you going to stop North Korea? You can't do it with nukes. You got to do it with the Chinese and the Russians helping you. This is not an argument for more bashing countries. It's an argument for getting our story together and getting multilateral support so we can control this problem.
Jack, real threats, real costs.
Real costs, $87 billion. And, of course, that reminded me of a pattern. I want to hear Professor Luchtenberg say something about this. Four reform movements in the 20th century, each really aimed to make life better for the average American. World War I killed off progressivism. The New Deal ended with World War II. Korea ended Harry Truman's Fair Deal, including national health insurance. Vietnam, the Great Society. Again and again and again, we have paid in this country for our foreign adventures. I wonder if you could speak to that, Bill.
Bill Luxenberg.
I think that's absolutely right, Jack. And one of the things that's happened that we've not talked about is how the whole area of public discourse has been changed by 9/11 and by Bush and his administration's response to it, so that there are numbers of extraordinary things that have been happening. To take a single one, the Enron and related scandals, which easily match those of the Great Depression. They would have shaken up the country at an earlier time. Were forgotten within a year. The state of the economy, where even when you get economic gains, you don't improve the level of employment.
But there's the threat of weapons of mass destruction, of loose nukes, and God knows what else. Michael Ignatieff points right at it. Can that be ducked?
Oh, well, no, if one were doing something effective about it. Indeed, as I said, I supported the intervention in Afghanistan. That made a very good sense. I did not support the intervention in Iraq because the notion that that was going to deal with the problem of weapons of mass destruction seemed to me very flimsy, as so far it has proven to be. And indeed, what it has done is distract us from carrying on effectively in Afghanistan, where we have been losing ground in recent weeks.
Bill Luchtenberg, with that, we're out of time, but I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Fine, thank you very much.
William Luchtenberg, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Michael Ignatieff with us in the studio. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Pleasure.
Michael Ignatieff, Director of the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University. And Jack, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Stick around for another hour. Listeners, you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the wounds of 9/11 continue to heal slowly. This is On Point. For many Americans, another year of distance has made this second anniversary of 9/11 less punishingly emotional than last year. But for friends and family of those who died, the grief goes on. Gail Sheehy knows the struggle of those who lost close relatives on 9/11. She spent 18 months among the residents of Middletown, New Jersey, which lost more lives in the terrorist attacks than any town outside New York. Her new book, Middletown America, follows the community's slow road toward recovery. In this radio diary, Gail Sheehy urges all Americans to remember that the wounds of 9/11 heal slowly.
"We don't normally cover anniversaries," said the TV producer, whose network was undecided on how to handle the second anniversary of 9/11. The person calling on behalf of family members refrained from pointing out that Americans don't normally pass through security in the country's military command center and then get blown up at their desks, or go to work in the towers of Manhattan and face a choice between jumping out the window or being incinerated while their families watch the spectacle on TV. It is a natural human inclination to tune out reminders of a horrific event. A decade of lapsed memory followed our war in Vietnam. So why should we remember and reflect on September 11 at the risk of reopening wounds still painfully fresh? This is the most dangerous of anniversaries, the second. Support systems fade. Media turn away. Friends, family, even spouses tend to lose patience with those still sorrowing and parrot our culture's popular bromides. Time to move on. Put it behind us. And the cruelest of all cliches, closure. The very word closure implies the hole will just heal up and one can then plant another flower over it and move on. In truth, the wound never fully closes after a traumatic loss. The 3,000 lives taken on 9/11 robbed tens of thousands of family members and colleagues of those they loved. But that was only the first blow. The news on the second anniversary is that nearly half of those who vaporized in the Twin Towers left no identifiable trace, nothing, to make their deaths real so the grieving process can begin. Yet, among Americans lucky enough not to have directly suffered a loss on September 11, it is common to hear comments like, a lot of other people have lost their loved ones in auto accidents or sudden heart attacks. Why are we making such a big deal out of these deaths? What's different about us is that I buried my husband three times, says Debbie Hemshot of Middletown, New Jersey. The first time she buried mementos for her son's sake. The second time it was ashes from Ground Zero. Then the day after Mother's Day, Hemshot was called by the medical examiner's office. We found a piece of your husband. Who among the public would have guessed that the 9/11 victims' families were getting their loved ones back literally piece by piece? The Tejan family was relieved when told that their son, Kenny, one of the heroic Port Authority police officers who saved lives at the World Trade Center, had finally been identified by DNA testing. Just before Christmas, Kenny's sister, Lori, and two of his fellow officers went into New York to collect the remains. The two cops emerged from the makeshift morgue, ashen-faced, carrying a stretcher covered with a flag, a stretcher with only a few tiny bumps on it. Lori cried aloud, "Where is everything?" When colleagues later asked Lori why she was so grumpy, she kept the grisly truth to herself. Like many of the families, she has internalized the societal pressure to get on with it. Beyond the families of victims, tens of thousands of witnesses and survivors from 9/11 are carrying heavy baggage, many of them suffering flashbacks and panic attacks. When Port Authority police officers opened up to this writer, it was clear they were fearful of acting out their anger and sense of helplessness. "Am I going to flip out like one of those rescue people after Columbine or Oklahoma City?" one officer blurted. "I have so much anger. Am I going to go postal? Kill myself or someone else?" Oklahoma City points the way to the future. 8 years after suffering the deadliest terrorist bombing on American soil up to that time, those survivors have learned that the psychological effects of trauma by terrorism are cumulative. And if they are ignored into the third year, the likely reaction is a double-dip depression. The alternative to pretending we can get over it by forgetting is to renew the memories of those taken from us. We can best do that by celebrating the way they lived rather than recalling the way they died. Tell their stories. Bring them up as a teaching moment for the lives we are living now. Remind ourselves to do the important things we wish we had done before. As Thornton Wilder wrote in The Bridge of San Luis Rey, "There is a land of the living and a land of the dead, and the bridge is love, the only survival, the only meaning."
Stephen Francis Schlegg.
John Schlissel.
Karen Helene.
Gail Sheehy is the author of Middletown, America, One Town's Thomas Passage, G. From Trauma to Hope.
Frank G.
I'm Tom Ashbrook.
Gerard,
this is On Point.
Schrank.
Jeffrey H. Schreier.
John T. Schroeder.
Susan Lee Schuler.